The Bible tells us how God made a covenant with Abraham and promised him that through him all families or nations of the earth would be blessed. The Savior told his followers in the Americas that he was going to show himself to these lost tribes of Israel, for they are not lost unto the Father, for he knoweth whither he hath taken them.
To be close, to be here with you, and now with all my heart I will lay down precisely at your feet.
Truly the gospel is for all men everywhere.
Dearest one, I had a dream. I mouthed the words, the sound came out. I spoke to you in Japanese.
Lost tribes of Israel.
I cannot see, I heard your name. And all at once there was no place I'd rather be. All at once there was no place that I would rather be.
The Lord will eventually cause the inspired teachings he has given to his children in various nations to be brought forth for the benefit of all people. This will include accounts of the visit of the resurrected Lord to what we call the lost tribes of Israel.
Infants on thrones, the philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today we're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects of all time. Or at least something that used to be one of my favorite subjects of all time. The Lost Tribes of Israel. Or more specifically, the Japanese people and the Lost Tribes of Israel. Because I went to Japan on my mission, and this was what they told me. Honest. And joining me for this conversation are two fellow Japanese missionaries and fellow Lost Tribe enthusiasts, Brad.
We were just returning the lost sheep. I mean, they at one point had the true religion, and they had bastardized it.
And Nick.
That is where it came up. It came up in that class, like, oh yeah, we Japanese, we are of the Lost Tribes of Israel, you know. And I'm like, that's not in the manual.
And we also have Allison, who plays the all-important role of, hang on, what the heck are you guys talking about?
Okay, wait, what are you talking about? Go to the baby class.
So, let's get right to it. Nick, where did you serve in your mission?
I was in Tokyo North.
Okay. And what years were you there?
96 to 98.
Okay. So you were there several years after Brad and I. Because Brad and I were Okayama mission, which is now Hiroshima. And I was 91 to 93. And what were you, Brad? 92 to 94?
Yep.
Okay.
March to March.
So that's what? Three to five years afterwards, something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. About five. You said 96 to 98.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And Allison, have you heard this? That we're going to talk about the Japanese being the lost tribes of Israel. And as a convert, did you ever even hear about the lost tribes of Israel? Did you know what they were?
Not really. No. Like I'd heard that in church, but I always just, I don't know, just kind of glazed over it. Like,
so even in church, when you would hear about it, it never became interesting to you?
I wouldn't say it's not interesting. I never got into it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I never stopped somebody to say, wait, what are you talking about? Because if you do that in gospel doctrine and you're a little woman,
yeah.
I don't know how to say this. Like,
oh, no,
you're
I
not
totally
like a,
understand what
you're
saying.
Like a commanding
totally
man who's going to be like, wait, let's discuss this.
Yeah.
Like, if you ask a question, then, I don't know, I tended to get a lot of eye rolls and, like, oh, she doesn't know anything kind of stuff.
I wonder if they were really eye rolls or if you just felt a little self-conscious.
I don't know. I had some really pompous, just know-it-alls in my ward where it's like, if you question, you know, go to the baby class. What is it called? Gospel principles.
Yeah. Go to the baby class.
Go to that class if you don't know what we're talking about.
Wow. What about you, Nick? Did you have a fascination with lost tribes before your mission?
No, but right as I started, I'd been in the mission for about, I think 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And on P-Day, my companion, who was native Japanese, he was asleep, and we got a phone call. And somehow through my half broken Japanese, I understood they wanted us to teach the next high priest group meeting lesson on whatever topic was next. And in my youthful missionary zeal, I said, "Oh, I'll do that." And they said, "Are you sure?" I'm like, "Sure, my 3 week Japanese can do that." And I said, "Okay, well, it's lesson 25 on the lost tribes of Israel, and good luck with that."
Wow.
So yeah, so I somehow stumbled through a lesson of on the lost tribes of Israel, and that is where it came up. It came up in that class, like, "Oh yeah, we Japanese, we are of the lost tribes of Israel, you know." And I'm like, "That's not in the manual."
Yeah, right.
I missed that paragraph.
So that, so the first time you really. I mean, did you know about the Lost Tribes before that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It just wasn't that interesting to you.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe can you give like a brief overview of what this is, Lost Tribes?
Well, okay. So you've got Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? Jacob's name was changed to Israel, and then he had 12 sons. Mm-hmm. And each one of those 12 sons then became the head of what was known as a tribe of Israel. And when Jacob or Israel blessed each one of his 12 sons, and this is somewhere in the book of Genesis, I think, he gave them specific promises. And this was like his send-off. "I'm going to bring you all, I'm going to give you these blessings, and then I'm going to die. And this is your mission and for all of your posterity afterwards." It's kind of where the whole idea of a patriarchal blessing comes from, being tied to Jacob and the tribes of Israel. And so there's different blessings that are tied to these different tribes. And, you know, I don't remember all what they were. But, you know, then you've got the group of people, they go into Egypt because of the famine, you know, Joseph, the coat of many colors, they go into Egypt. And then they get, they turned into slaves, and 400 years goes by. Then Moses brings them out and puts them into the promised land. And while they've been in Egypt, they've maintained their identity based on their tribe, like what tribe they're from. So when they finally establish a kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, they all have their different quarters of the city or whatever by tribe. And then there's some friction between the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Ephraim. And Ephraim was one of Joseph's sons. And it was tied back to the blessing that Jacob gave them, who was going to have the authority of being the ruler. And so you get a division of the kingdoms. Ephraim in the north, which consists of two of the tribes, and then the tribe of Judah in the south, which is 10 tribes. And so what happens then in like 721 BC, the Assyrians come in and they conquer the 10 tribes in the southern kingdom, and they capture them and they take them. Am I mixing it up?
Yeah, I think it's the reverse. I think it was Ephraim in the north with 10 tribes and Judah in the south,
right?
With Judah and Benjamin.
Yeah, that's right.
Correct.
Judah and Benjamin are in the south. And so the Ephraim, yeah, the 10 tribes were in Ephraim, because that's why we're Ephraim, because we're the restored, we are the lost tribes, basically. The Assyrians take the 10 tribes and they never come back. They're gone. They're disappeared. And so in the church, you always hear that in the last days, it's prophesied before Jesus comes back that the 10 tribes are going to return. And, you know, like in the Book of Mormon, when Jesus visits the Nephites, he says, you know, "When I was in Jerusalem, I told them, 'Other sheep I have which are not of this fold.' And I was talking about you guys." You know, if you know, you guys know that New Testament book that I'm referring to. Oh, you don't? Oh, okay. Well, never mind. The people who read this in 1,000 years will. But I'm telling you guys that I also have other sheep that are not of this fold. And those are the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And I'm going to visit them, and they're going to write down my words. And when they come back in the last days, they're going to bring the scriptures with them. So there will be an even another record, another record of or testament of Jesus Christ. And so, you know, Joseph Smith was always thinking sequel. You know, sealed portion, lost tribes. He was setting himself up for more and more scriptures to just keep coming and coming. Anyway, so we have this promise of scriptures coming from lost tribes, and that they're somewhere, they're going to return. There's all kinds of fascination about where they are. Or, you know, are they on another planet? Are they underneath the earth? You know, are they still together as a people, or were they just scattered and became the seeds? What is it called? The leaven or something of the earth? I don't know.
See, my dad had that all figured out. He knew exactly where they're at.
So then to answer the question that I asked Allison and Nick, you were raised in a home, Brad, that your dad was really interested in the lost tribes. So were you interested in them too?
Yes, but my dad, so, you know, back in the 80s, you know, back when the Soviet Union was still what they were,
right.
I think everybody was under the premise that they were within Soviet Russia. You know, you couldn't get in there and proselyte. And so that was where everybody thought the 10 lost tribes were. And my dad, you know, because it referenced the North and it referenced, you know, the fact that they had their own scripture or had received revelation. So people had built this narrative that they existed as a enclosed culture. They had their own prophets, they had their own things, and so my dad had a very fundamental mindset that when the time would come, that the signs of the times, that they would actually come out as a group, march down this highway out of the north, bearing prophets and scriptures. And so, you know,
well, it says that in the Doctrine and Covenants. It says that the ice is going to be broken, and so that's what people say, oh, they're in the North Pole.
Right.
And that, go ahead.
And so to that point, you know, did I think about or ponder where else could they be? I really didn't. And so it wasn't until I got to Japan and heard the Japanese saints and President Utagawa, you know, talk about, you know, what they were going to be or that they were a part of the 10 lost tribes. I was like, holy crap, I guess they're not all Russian.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the lost tribes as a kid, and I really wanted to know where they were, and I would pray to find out, you know, that if I was worthy enough, the Lord would reveal it to me. And I think there was like a B.H. Roberts thing that's We Are of Israel, and he talks about this migration north. That when the Assyrians took them, they put them out and spread them in different places. But then they got together and they left, and they took a journey north. And they had their prophets like Moses, and they had their backsliders like Laman and Lemuel. And who more likely to be a backslider than the proud tribe of Ephraim? And so that's why there's so much of the blood of Ephraim in northern Europe, because as they were going north towards the North Pole, people broke off and became the early Britons, or you know. And so that's why when Joseph Smith made his claim that he was related directly to Joseph of Egypt, it was coming through this tribe of Ephraim, through, you know, the British Isles into the new promised land of America. And so just like, you know, the three of us that served our mission in Japan, you know, we're going to talk about all the clues that the Japanese are the lost tribes of Israel. Well, there's also a large group of traditions around the British Isles that they're the lost tribes of Israel too. And this isn't something that's limited just to Mormons either, I should point out. There's fundamental or evangelical Christians that believe that the Japanese are the lost tribes of Israel, or any group of people. There's all these groups of people that have been identified at one point or another as being the lost tribes of Israel, and that really just speaks to the pervasiveness of Western Christianity, you know, in discovering new people. They're always like, okay, the Bible said that they're out there. Maybe we've discovered them. Maybe this is where they are, and we're connecting the old world to the new and things like that. Anyway.
Well, and that's funny. In preparation for this conversation, I Googled it a little bit, and you can say lost tribes any country, and you will get these themes and parallels of where it's got to be them, and it's funny.
Yeah, and it's because if you're able to find that there really are lost tribes, then you've got it's just like finding a piece of Noah's Ark up in the mountains in Russia. You know, it's like, oh, the Bible's true because we found the evidence of this thing. So, you know, there's a Nova. History did a documentary on the Ethiopian Jews, or that there are these traditions that Ethiopians have that maybe they were the lost tribes of Israel because they, I don't know, fill in the blank, that they have rituals that are similar to what are described in the Bible. And where would that come from unless it was this group of people that had continued this for hundreds and thousands of years? So anyway, that kind of sets the stage. Does that answer your question, Allison?
Yeah, that was a very good breakdown. Yeah. And yeah. I've heard the thing about people thinking that it was in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. that there's lost tribes. I'd heard some of those things, but I am not, the only familiarity I have with it as far as Japan is just the stuff that you talked about in your other podcast, Glenn, about that.
Okay. So Nick, you said you first heard about it in that, high priest, wait, high priest? Yeah, you were teaching high priest?
I was teaching high priest group, and that came up as part of it. You know, I'm going to the typical follow the lesson manual. Here's what the lesson says about it. And the conversation took a really weird turn, and I didn't pick up on it at first because I had been in the country for 3 weeks and really wasn't picking up on much of anything. Right. And it dawned on me that they were talking about, you know, the fact that they were the lost tribes of Israel, and this is where it was, and it was Japan, and we Japanese in the way that, you know, the Japanese only can do. And that's when my curiosity really got piqued. That, you know, so it started very early in my mission. And the sort of, you know, lore of Christianity generally, but, you know, that kind of mythos became very interesting.
How about you, Brad? The first time you heard about it connected to Japan was in the Zone conference that our president Utagawa gave.
Yeah, and he might even have given it really when I'd either just gotten there or right before I got there, because I have trouble remembering him talking about it, but I remember a lot of the missionaries debriefing it for you know, months afterwards, you know, that, oh, yeah, he mentioned this or that. And I don't know if I was just so new in the mission that I was still just lost at Zone Conference.
It was when I was in Okayama, which was the area just before I transferred to Matsue, where we were together. So I don't know if it happened while you were in your first weeks or just before you got there. But I remember I was in that Okayama building listening to him talk about it. And my first exposure to it, though, was in the missionary training center in the MTC, because one of the teachers that we had was a Japanese woman from Tottori, Japan, and we probably hadn't been there 3 days. And she said, "You guys, I've got to share this with you because I'm so excited for you." That she told us the story of the Passover, and we're like, "Okay, all right." She said, "What happened with the Passover?" Well, this is where Moses told Pharaoh, "Let my people go." Pharaoh said, "No, I'm not going to do it." And okay, the angel of death is going to come and kill the firstborn male unless you do what? You slaughter a lamb and you paint the posts and the top of the door red. Okay. And she said, "You remember that in the Bible?" And we were like, "Yeah." And then she showed us a picture of a Japanese torii gate, which is like this, you know, deep orange, reddish gate on the sides and on the top going across, you know, like the little ends point up. And she's like, "Does that look familiar?"
We're like, it looks like Japan. She's like, no, look, it's red on the sides and red on the top. Why do you think that is? Like, I don't know. And she goes, because of the Passover. And we were so confused. We're like, well, okay, I did connect the dots for us. And then she told us it's because the Japanese are the lost tribes of Israel. And there's all kinds of traditions in Japan that most people don't know about that originated from Israel. And that was my first exposure to it. And the Japan part of it, which made me really happy because I thought that they were in Russia, like Brad said, and I wanted to be called on my mission to go to Russia because I wanted to work with the Lost Tribes because my patriarchal blessing told me that I would. And then I got a call to Japan. I was really disappointed. But then I heard this. I'm like, booyah, yeah. I'm going there. It's happening. And you know, then we had this sister, I think I told the story in the patriarchal blessing one, that said that she'd have language skills that would help her read the records that the Lost Tribes brought. So we were really excited. And then we had another teacher in the MTC that was an expert on this. His name was Petzinger. And he did a slideshow presentation to us while we were in the Missionary Training Center that ran down probably like 10 to 15 of the most common clues or evidences that the Japanese are the lost tribes. And we can get to some of those a little bit later on. But that was my first exposure to it. And I just, I bought it completely. I was so excited.
And now it's confession time.
Yeah.
When I taught at the MTC, I did the exact same thing. Yep. There are more things I added into the story, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Oh, you created new evidences?
Oh, no, I didn't create them. I actually believed them. I had new things to add. The Torii Gate was just the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you have the straight and narrow path and the two, you know, dog lions and what they say.
Okay, what's straight and narrow path? What's that?
So when – this is, I think, the most common one. Maybe Glenn will disagree. But the Japanese temples that you have there, and speaking specifically of the Shinto, the indigenous religions shrines, that's what is associated with these red gates, right? Kind of the iconic gates. They're called torii. And as you go in, there is always a straight path, and it's usually fairly narrow, that goes to the what's called – I believe it's the honden, the actual sort of like – place where the holy thing is enshrined. And so you enter in by the gate, the red Passover, blood of the lamb, all of that, enter in by the gate, follow the straight and narrow path. And then as you go in, there are these lion dog things. They're called koinu. Komainu. And one of them has its mouth open, usually, and one of them has its mouth closed. The open mouth is saying, ah. The closed mouth is saying, mm. Ah is the first letter of the alphabet syllabary in Japanese. N is the last, the first and the last, alpha and omega, blah 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 blah. That's it right there.
I can just imagine you guys like so excited, like
Japan,
and you're like.
It was, but those were some of the weakest ones to me. I mean, even back then when I was a believer, like straight and narrow path, like what are the odds of that? Well, most paths are going to be straight, narrow, you know, I mean, like to me, I didn't see a ton of significance there. The alpha and omega with the dogs or lions or whatever they were, I thought maybe.
No,
there were other way stronger ones to me.
That one's true, by the way. The dog one, I actually Googled that.
Yeah.
But it's not Japanese. It's Sanskrit. Uh-huh. So like the incantation Om from Hinduism, that's where that comes from, which makes sense if you think about it, because the dogs were imported with Buddhism, which came from Hinduism and all of that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they're Jewish.
Yeah. What about you, Brad?
Well, you know, that dog one, that was the one that I remember. And I remember talking with a missionary companion in one city. We spent all afternoon, you know, next to these statues talking about it and how cool it was and how, you know, we had built you know, really, and everybody thinks about this, it was proof that there used to be one central core religion. And for us, that was the most magical concept was, you know, we were just returning the lost sheep. I mean, they at one point had the true religion, and they had bastardized it into all these other things. And it just made it so magical to be there, you know, reclaiming the lost sheep, honestly.
Yeah, I think I remember talking to you about it in outside of the Matsue Castle. There was a little Shinto shrine, and I stood in there and pointed some things out. That might have been you. I don't know. We were in that area.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah,
it sounds familiar.
Yeah,
I'll read it in my journal and see.
Perfect. Awesome. Yeah. To me, the strongest connection was the Mikoshi. So the Mikoshi is a portable shrine that. If you read the description of the Ark of the Covenant, which everybody knows from Indiana Jones, you know, it's all covered in gold. Well, the Mikoshis are usually black, or maybe they're painted red or something, but they're ornamented with a lot of gold. And there's like cherub type images on it that it could be an eagle or something with wings, but they're carried on people's shoulders, usually. I mean, there's some that are on wheels, but usually they're carried on people's shoulders, and it at times of festival. So there are people singing and dancing, and there's priests that hold it that are dressed all in white, and they carry it on their shoulders.
Yes.
And you know, you hear that story in the Bible about the guy who reached out to steady the ark when. It was slipping, and he wasn't authorized to, so he was struck dead on the spot. You know, it's because they would carry the Ark of the Covenant this way, and so and inside the Mikoshi, it's a portable shrine that has whatever the sacred object inside of the temple is inside of it. And to me, I thought, wow, that is a bullseye right there. You know, what other group of people in the world has something like the Ark of the Covenant that they carry around? That's got to be where that came from.
That one never really resonated with me because
really?
Festivals just generally are kind of batshit crazy. I mean, it's you've got this reserved people who all of a sudden just completely lose their shit and they go nuts. And maybe I was just distracted by all the dancing and singing and public drunkenness and all of that kind of a thing. But you know, I saw the Mikoshi. I'm like, yeah, it's a mini temple, whatever. And
well, we had
never really resonated.
There was I don't know if you ever saw this, Brad, but there was a like Xerox lore kind of thing, alternate first discussion. That some sister missionary in northern Japan had supposedly written back in the early 70s, that was a way. And I've got it somewhere. Maybe I'll dig it up and I'll read some of this into the final edit here. But it was like sitting down from Mr. Tanaka and saying, you know, Mr. Tanaka, you know, you work 5 days a week. You've got a weekend, then you've got a sacred day. Do you know why you have that? Well, it's because in the Bible. In the book of Genesis, it talks about having a Sabbath day. And basically what it does is it takes all of these clues about the Japanese being the lost tribes of Israel and it weaves it into the first discussion to say, your history, you can learn more about your real history if you learn about our church. And one of the things that it highlighted was the Mikoshi, and it read the verses in Kings or Genesis or wherever it is that King David would dance in the streets and play music and drums, and the description of it was so much like what I saw with the Matsuri, with the festivals, that it fit. So I didn't see a disconnect there like you described, Nick. I saw it being exactly what the Bible had described, because that's what this lesson plan described it as, and that's how it entered my consciousness. But yeah, to me that was the one that I was always the most excited about, was the Mikoshi.
Did any of you get into the Buddhist mudras, the hand signs of the various iconography?
I remember hearing people say things that, like, if you pay close enough attention and remember what you did in the temple, that's all I'm going to say.
So the most popular one that was always big for us is it's called the Abhaya Mudra, which is obviously not Japanese. And it what it is it's, you know, it's usually your typical Buddhist iconography. It has the right hand raised sort of in salutation, and the left hand is extended palm upwards. And if you see a picture of it, you're like, oh, well, I may have seen that in somewhere, but I can't talk about that now. and that one was sort of like people would kind of do a little bit of a, you know, kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge whenever we'd see that.
That's interesting. I'm familiar with what you're talking about because we I've dabbled in Eastern religions a little bit. So, and I never put those two together. That's really interesting.
Being a missionary is sort of like having your mind really played with in a weird, disturbing way. Mm-hmm. And so I think we were probably more prone to see all of that stuff. Mm.
So then with the things that don't really fit, like all the other hand gestures that are, you know, like where they do it's like an okay symbol kind of thing.
That was clearly corrupted through time.
Right. Yeah, that's what I figured you'd think. Yeah.
There was the one that remained pure. but Nick, I don't think it's just the missionaries that feel the sense of appeal, because your first exposure to it were these Japanese high priests.
Oh, very
fair. They were
fair.
The ones that were telling you that they were the lost tribes.
Well, Japan's got this bizarre and kind of very rich history with Christianity generally, and I think that this is my opinion, but I think that plays into their consciousness a little bit, because when the first missionaries, and we're not talking Mormon missionaries, we're talking the Jesuits and the Franciscans, you know, way back in the 16th century, when they first showed up, they were wildly successful for years, and I remember once on a P-Day just stumbling on an old cemetery, very old, with a lot of you know, names on it, and you could read it, and it would say, you know, Maria or you know, John or something like that, and you're like, you're looking at these and go, a Japanese person named Maria? Right. And then it would click that, oh yeah, these are all the Catholic converts from back in the day. And one of the beliefs that I heard an awful lot was the reason why the missionaries from that era had been so successful in preaching Christianity was because they were lost tribes of Israel, and right. So it resonated with them. And therefore, you know, we Mormon missionaries must really suck because we weren't having that great of success.
Well, did you guys hear the legend or the rumor that there was a Star of David on some, like, Shinto shrines, you know, super couple thousand year old shrines around the Tokyo area?
Yeah, well, and it wasn't just any, it was the shrine at Issei.
Yes, which is like that is the
Israel.
One.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's of course the
though. I mean, it's yeah. That there's the Star of David that's on those stone lanterns there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and then way far in the north, you have the grave of Jesus.
In Hedai, yeah.
Yeah. It's,
Spencer Palmer wrote about that in a BYU studies. Have you guys ever read that?
I haven't read his article.
I haven't. I'm hearing this for the first time. Are we talking Jesus or Jesus? I mean, was it just like some...
There's a place that you can go in Hedai, and there's a tomb, and they say, or there's a grave, they say, Jesus... The Jesus who died on the cross was actually Jesus's brother who stepped in for him at the last minute, and Jesus escaped. And, you know, the lost youth years where the Bible doesn't talk about Jesus from like 12 to 30, he actually spent traveling the East and learning the wisdom from, you know, the people in India and China, and came to Japan. And so when he was escaping persecution, he always wanted to go back to Japan because it was kind of awesome there. And so that's where he came after his brother died, James. His brother James died for him on the cross, and everybody thought it was Jesus. And then Jesus married a nice Japanese woman and settled down. They had two kids, and he died at a nice ripe old age of 86, you know, or something like that.
That's and a cool story.
It is. And then there's this this document called the Takeuchi document that's supposedly written by Jesus at the time. And so Spencer Palmer talks about, you know, there's this this legend that exists. And he goes, of course, as Latter-day Saints, we know that that didn't really happen. But what probably happened, what he suggests, is that Jesus appeared to them in the meridian of time. And the memory of that persisted, and then the other stories were built up around it as part of the apostasy, you know. But there's this core truth to it. There's also in the northern, most northern part of Japan, the Innu people.
Oh, yes.
That are white.
Right. European looking.
It's yeah, with blue eyes. And well, it's because it's so close to Russia, right? But in my mind, I thought Lamanites and Nephites. Absolutely. Just like in the US, we've got our reservations with the darker skinned Lamanite ancestors. In Japan, where the Lamanites were the ones that won, they've got their reservations with the Nephite version, like the one.
Well, you've wrecked it for me now. I used to think that the Ainu were so cool that they were, you know, some sort of, you know, European immigrants or something. And yeah, it makes sense that they're just Russians.
They have long beards. Yeah, right.
Yeah, they're known to be whiter and hairier than your normal Japanese.
Yeah. With a different language, and that they have a legend of a white god who came down to them, you know, or something like that. You would always hear these stories about legends, and it always was like kind of what you brought up before, Allison. Like there's this one thing where there's kind of a similarity, and you just have to ignore all the other things that aren't a similarity and chalk that up to the apostasy that the people went through and the bastardization of truth.
Well, I love that it's more plausible to whoever told you that story wasn't true. It's more plausible that Jesus appeared in the meridian of time than that he just walked and traveled a lot.
Yeah, right.
I buy the other story personally, but.
Well, that bastardization of truth has, especially as it relates to Christianity, has this huge tradition that actually did happen from the time of the Franciscans and Jesuits. What happened was in 1614, I think it was, they decided that they were going to stamp out all the Christians and they were going to kick them out and take care of it. And so all the Christians, and there were many, who were indigenous Japanese, were forced to apostatize. And the way they did this was by making them step on an iconography of the Virgin Mary and the infant Jesus as proof that they'd apostatized, the foot being, you know, nasty and dirty and all of that. Well, so a lot of these people, just to preserve themselves and not get crucified or all sorts of other things, actually did it and felt really guilty about it. But then for generations continued practicing Catholicism in their home, secret from the government. And so when the United States shows up in the 1850s or 60s and opens up sort of Japan to the rest of the world again, they come in there and they find these pocket groups of Christians, especially
Kakure
in the South.
Christians.
Kakure, that's what they were
hidden.
Called. Kakureru is to be hidden. Yeah. And they had this really bastardized form of Christianity where they would actually kind of speak this funky Latin thing. They kind of had weird Latin phrases. Mind you, this is several generations removed. This is, what, 250-ish years from the time that they'd actually had the last Christian stamped out. But then when the Catholics came over, this group of Kakure Christians would not incorporate back into the Catholic Church because they felt that they were different now and didn't really – they either weren't worthy or that the integration wouldn't work. And so they have this kind of hybrid Christian but not really sort of thing going on.
Yeah. And of course, didn't that excite you when you heard that as Mormons? Because it kind of validates the whole apostasy, the great apostasy and restoration narrative. You're like, see, these things do happen. We just happen to be the ones that have the restored truth.
Yes.
It makes sense.
Well, and it also appeals to that narrative, you know, that whole, you know, everybody, you know, tells their own personal narrative and you want it to be great and impressive. And so when you can, you know, it appeals to that desire to be, I guess, recognized and to be great. I mean, you are bringing that thing. You are a tool to God. I mean, that's missionaries lap that up.
Yeah. You know, when I studied folklore, and I focused on this for my master's thesis, but when they talked about beliefs or legends, they say that these things continue because they have a valuable function. It's doing something. And a lot of times the things that a legend does, it validates a belief. And so what you're talking about there, Brad, this idea that we have the truth and that we're really called of God and that we're out to do that, these stories completely validated our missions to us. It validated the truthfulness of what we were doing. And I think going back to what you said earlier, Nick, that yeah, it does this for the missionaries, but it also the members, they've got a slightly different twist on this. And if for them it validates their conversion to Mormonism, because what was the thing that you always heard when you would knock on a door or ring a doorbell? I mean, first you'd hear Kecko Des, which is just like, right, no thank you. But the other thing that was very common was Uchiwa Bukyo. Our mm-hmm. house is Buddhist. We're Buddhists. And that's the way that they formed an identity. We're not Christian, we're Buddhists. So what happens when somebody rejects that identity? Because you know in Japan, you don't want to be somebody who stands out, you know, that Deru Kuiga, what is it?
The nail that sticks out is hammered down.
Yeah.
Right.
That's one of those proverbs that, I mean, it really explains the Japanese people very well. So they take a risk when they convert to Christianity in general, but specifically to Mormonism.
Well, absolutely.
But if they can see this as they're not rejecting their ancestors, they're reclaiming their ancestors, they're making it better. The Buddhist was when their ancestors went away into their great apostasy, and now they've been restored to their true original Japanese-ness. This is the true essence of Japan. To me, that's what the real powerful part of it that you're getting in that high priest lesson, where people are saying, yep, we are. This is us.
Absolutely. I mean, filial piety, ancestor reverence and worship is a massive, massive part of Japanese culture, you know, and to have that tie back to your ancestors was a huge thing for these people who have made to be Mormon in Japan is a huge sacrifice. I don't know that I've ever seen the level of family ostracization that I have seen. My trainer, for example, his mother would not acknowledge him as her son for his entire mission, wouldn't write him a letter, wouldn't talk with him on the phone. She actually said, I have no son, and that was that, because he'd converted.
Well, and it's built around, you know, in Buddhism that your descendants, you know, help, you know, really through their prayers and things, really, and I don't know the right words, but there's salvation or something where they're at caretakers of the ancestors. And you would hear the I can't get baptized, I'm the Chonon, I'm the oldest son, I owe it to my family to practice this faith because my ancestors are dependent upon me, no matter how true I think you may be. And that Chonon piece was like the worst element. I mean, you can break out of that.
That oldest son.
Like, I just wonder if you, like, obviously when you were missionaries, you believed this so strongly, and you knew that it was true, and so you wanted these people to convert. But didn't you ever feel like it wasn't the right thing for them then? If this was going to cause such a big rift in their families, didn't you want to just kind of like back off?
Hell no.
No. Guilt.
We were sitting on all the ordinances that would save them. Yeah, why wouldn't we share them? You know, there's only one path to the celestial kingdom.
Like, damn the family. They'll have them in eternity if their families choose to be baptized when they're dead. Or, you know, that's kind of how you thought.
I got it over that fairly quickly with in my first area. There was an investigator who was not Japanese, actually. He was Iranian. And for him to convert, at least I thought, and I was probably right, he told us, for him to convert meant death if when he went home. They would, you know, capture him and decapitate him because you couldn't do that or some such thing. How true that was, I don't know, but that's what we thought. And yet, you know, since he was the only person who spoke English that we had in our investigator pool, it was my job to teach him from day one. And, hey, just bold as brass right out of the MTC. Hey, you're going to die if you convert? Great. Will you be baptized? I did that. And then after that, you know, kind of asking people to break up with their family, not that big of a deal. I was kind of a little bit of a dick.
Yeah, well, but you think you're saving them.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Well, you do. And I even heard that argument of Chonon. We hit on that. I actually, in my head, was like, that is another sign that they are the lost tribes, because that's like the priesthood was handed down father to son. So that is an old, you know, vestigial remnant of what that priesthood handoff was. So when they say, you know, Chonon, I'd even try to explain that, well, even that concept of you have obligations is, you
birthright.
Know, kind of a, yeah, birthright. It mimics, you know, priesthood keys that are handed down. I mean, you know, you can build whatever narrative you want as a missionary.
So you didn't have that feeling back then, but now do you, like, well, how do you feel about it now?
Glenn,
you don't believe
it
anymore.
Glenn hit on this a year or so ago, where he talked about cultural imperialism. Mm-hmm. And that's how I view it now. Yeah. I mean, it was, we would tromp on all of these old you know, customs, explain them away, or explain them so that they matched our customs, and then tell them how it really was, when all we're doing is reinventing their story. We wouldn't listen to theirs.
And I don't know if you guys were like this. I mean, like, Nick, you said that you were a little bit of a dick, so maybe you were, yeah, maybe you were like this, but there was this sense of indignation that here I am as a missionary. I have sacrificed 2 years of my life to come and bring this simple saving message to the Japanese people, and they don't even have the time of day to give me 2 minutes, you know? So I knock on a door, they say, Kekko des. I'm not, you know, no thank you. Knock on a door, Kekko. Knock on a door, Kekko. Knock on a door, Kekko. And you just get so tired of it that there's this antagonism that goes along with your good intentions as a missionary as well. And, like, I came up with this little song that I used to sing when I would get really frustrated, and it was a take on a Mr. Rogers tune.
It's such a good feeling. A very good feeling, the feeling, you know, that I'll be back when the day is new, and I'll have more ideas for you, and you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will too.
And I'd sing, it's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling, you know, that I'll be back when the end is near. And you'll be burned to hell. And there'll be things you'll want to talk about. I'll Kekko you.
Wow, that's bitter.
Yeah.
That's really bitter.
But
that's,
you know,
so sad to me. Like, I get it. I know that
for
you didn't
real.
Mean it. But I'm saying,
kind of, I did.
For right now, where you're at now, where you know it's all crap. And, like, just to think about the families that have been broken up, and the traditions that, like, hundreds of years, these people believed the same thing. And then you come in and you just trash it. And you think that, you know, you make them think that they're doing a good thing. And
geez, now you're making me feel like I don't feel bad enough.
I'm sorry. I just can't. No, here's what it is. Cause I've been out of the church for, you know, a few years now. And I didn't expect it. I've kind of gone through all the things, right? Like, I know all the things that piss me off, and there's not a lot new anymore. And this is, like, one of them tonight. And I wasn't expecting it. And I just think it's heartbreaking. Sorry.
I have had, and maybe, Glenn, I know you've been there several times, lived over there for a while after your mission, and this maybe will be sort of the same for you. I've been back several times, and one time was right in the teeth of my faith crisis a couple years ago. And I was up in one of the areas I served in was Nagano, right during and around the time of the Olympics. And up in Nagano, and you may have seen it on TV, there's this big, huge Buddhist temple called Zenkoji up there. And it was kind of the centerpiece of that town. It's a beautiful old building. And on the cultural imperialism theme, as missionaries, we'd go there. And if you go in and you pay some money, there's actually kind of this dark path that you go through to find kind of like the thing that's special that represents salvationist type of a thing. And you'd go in there and you'd have to feel on these pitch black walls to find this sort of rattly handle that you touched. And if you touched that, that meant you were saved. And of course, we created into this the Lehi's dream allegory. Yes, exactly. Wow. That's what that was. And that was a rod. And the rod was there for the handicapped people to go down the stairs. That's why it was there. But to us, this was the rod of iron. And so if you imagine this, right, this was the mindset I was in. Well, I go back there. It's only about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I'm right in the teeth of my faith crisis. But this time, I actually have studied Japanese language and culture now. That's what my undergrad degree is in. So I have the wherewithal to read what's going on. I know I know the history here. I've looked it up. And I wanted to go back and visit this place. Well, it turns out that this temple has very special meaning to women. It's a very important temple for women in particular. This kind of tied in with the new awakening I had as part of my disaffection, which involved the way that I was treating my wife and the sort of me struggling with how do I deal with my daughters in the church. And I go and I make this pilgrimage up there, and I felt it as a pilgrimage, and I experienced it from a completely different level. And the cultural imperialism that I had brought with me at first was gone, and I was experiencing this in a completely different way, where it meant something. If you want to call it a spiritual experience, you can. As a semi-atheist agnostic, I don't know that I do, but it was a profound and meaningful experience to go through this understanding and reading and appreciating the Japanese history behind it and the culture. And as I'm looking at this wall that used to offend me so badly, where the women who had there was a wall next to this temple. It was kind of on a side temple where they would tie their prayers being little pieces of paper, and it was just covered. It was specifically dedicated to women who'd had abortions. And as missionaries, we went up there and were just completely offended by the fact that this was up there. Going up there again, I look at this and I kind of see the pain that these women are feeling because they're having an abortion, and yet they feel the need to have a spiritual journey to tie their prayer, and it's been a difficult situation. That was one of the most powerful influences of my life, and if you want to call it repentance or sorrow, in that moment I realized how horrible I had been. I wanted to go around to everybody I'd ever talked to and said, I'm so sorry. Can we ignore what I told you last time? And just, you teach me all about you guys, because you guys are wonderful. I just want to know more about you and learn more about you. And forget this Jewish culture stuff. Let's learn about you guys. I feel like, if you will, I repented. But it was a hard realization to come to that I had been, so horrible to these people.
You were doing what you thought was right, and it wasn't horrible because that's what you've been taught to do, and so you're not, I don't know if you're culpable for that, but I don't mean to make you guys feel more guilty. I was just it's just one more thing.
right.
Well, it feels to me that it was really myself. Like I was impeding my own progress because I wasn't open to learning what I could learn from the Japanese. I looked at it like that it was some bastardized version of the truth, and the only value that it had to me was building on relationships of trust so that I could get in good with the person I was talking to, and then cut right to the chase and get them to believe and convert and stuff. So it was a means to an end that way. But so the epiphany that Nick described, that's something that I think people are able to experience when they travel and they're open to receiving new things about a culture that I just was completely not. So I think I did more damage to myself or you know, that I was impeding the potential for growth than when I look at people that joined the church. I don't feel like I really did any damage to them because they were also seeking. I mean, I didn't force anything on anybody. I don't understand some of them, but like when I've mentioned before this guy Cabo that I interviewed several years ago for Mormon Expression, and I don't think he's the bishop, but maybe he's a first counselor in the bishop. He's still active, and he had a son born with some disability that he didn't live much past 8-9 years old. And the gospel was a really comforting thing for him and his family. And you know, feeling that they're going to be together forever, that they're going to see him right. forever. You know, he's formed an identity around this that he loves and just embraces. And so it's hard for me to look and go, oh, I harmed him some way, you know, because
sure.
I think there's a common theme with people that do get baptized in Japan where they naturally have a Western focus. I mean, a lot of them are studying English. Mm-hmm. They first meet the missionaries and build relationships with them because they're intrigued by the Americanness. Yeah. And so it's more of them wanting to know about America, and that's how they onboard the religion as it's just a piece of America. Whereas, you know, anybody who was very focused on their own beliefs, culture, those things that were where they were so interested on those are the ones that there would be keko desu or wakarimasen or whatever it was. I don't understand. No thanks. I'm not interested. Or they would just ignore you. You know, so in the end, you know, I guess I agree a little bit with Glenn where it takes two to tango, where, you know, if they weren't buying, no matter what you're selling, yeah, it wouldn't work.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I'm sure that good came out of it, but no, for the times when it didn't, you know, mothers disown their sons because they're Mormon.
Like, well, I didn't baptize enough people to even be noticeable, so it was, you know, I the field was right white, ready to be harvested. Yeah, heck, I mean, but maybe two people.
You know, if a mother's disowning her son for something like that, to me, she's got an issue. I don't take responsibility for that.
Well, know? It's just one. No, and you shouldn't, because it's just one piece of a culture that's kind of messed up, battling right. against another culture that's right. imposing itself on it. And so that's an interesting dynamic. And you're right. It's not your fault. I just think that it's a shame, you know, like, it's not necessary, especially because it's not true.
Well, and I guess for me, as I'm hearing you talk, I'm thinking about probably Mormon people in general can't build healthy relationships with non-Mormons because they have the pressure of every member a missionary. And so, you know, we're talking about Japan, but I'm thinking about, you know, growing up and, you know, anytime you met somebody and built a relationship where they weren't LDS, I mean, you were getting pressure to give them a Book of Mormon, all these things. So, you know, it's just...
Yeah, I'm a little surprised at my reaction right now to what you're saying, Allison, because I'm getting kind of defensive of these people that and that maybe the way to approach it isn't whether or not it's true, but whether or not it's valuable to them.
And see, I don't think it is.
It's not valuable to you. It's not valuable to me. But I think about I went back. I don't remember exactly when it was, but it was the 30-year anniversary of the church coming onto the island of Shikoku, and so they had a big stake conference, a party, and they knew that I was coming over in advance, and they asked me to bring root beer extract so that they could make root beer. You know, and like the Japanese hate root beer, just as a general rule. Yeah. They say it tastes like medicine, but medicine, they wanted to have a Utah-style Mormon party. So bring the root beer, and they have, and it was, you know, it was like they were.
It's fun.
But it was so strange to me because I was sitting in the chapel and they put on, I think it was Legacy, and they were talking about the pioneers that are crossing the plains to Utah, and I'm looking around at everybody in the congregation and there's tears streaming down their face, and they're totally connecting with these people in a different part of the world, different ancestry, different time, but they feel this kinship that because of the narrative of the gospel that they believe is true, they see themselves as figurative pioneers in Japan, and they think about all the hardships that they've endured. Maybe it's being disowned by a family member, or not being able to participate in some of the cultural things like a drinking party, nomikai, whatever that they have at work, or drinking the green tea ceremonial things that they just can't do that anymore. And they feel connected to something, and there's that value in there. And like I look at it, I'm kind of perplexed, but I don't want to be too judgmental of it either. I don't know. I'm feeling weird about it. I didn't expect this.
Right. No, yeah, it's a conflicting, yeah. Definitely conflicting feeling.
Well, I think the piece that stands out is that, you know, missionaries are so insensitive to understanding that culture. I don't think they do much damage. I mean, in the end, they have 18 months worth of language, and if people aren't interested, they're not getting their hooks in. But it's funny to look at it from this side of the fence now, and it's a lot of wasted effort is really my takeaway.
They do some damage, though, through the cultural imperialism for those who join up. And this may sound weird, but the place I see it the very most is actually in the language itself. I don't know if you had viewed this the same way, but the Japanese in the church, as spoken by native Japanese members, is weird. And it's weird because they have adopted the phrasing that the missionaries have used for years, which is not grammatically correct and or sounds very stilted. And now right. It's become kind of this cultural thing where they will pray in certain ways using certain formations that no native Japanese would have ever come right. up, but they've been using it for 30 years. So how are they, and they have words and phrases. And in fact, part of the challenge that I had when teaching Japanese people was learning the better words to describe certain concepts in Mormon theology, because the ones that we actually used in the church were weird.
Archaic.
Yeah. But I think I there's probably English language correlations to that as well. I mean, you think about different Christian churches, the way that they pray compared to the way that Mormons pray. You know, the these and thines. Like I've had my younger brother who left the church and was baptized into a Christian church. We were all together as a family, and my dad, trying to impose some of his own cultural imperialism, is like, "All right, Jeff, why don't you say the prayer?" And so he goes, "God, we're really glad that we're all gathered together today. We sure love each other a lot, and we thank you." I'm like, he went into this very informal conversational thing that to us just sounded so bizarre,
right.
But it was just natural. So I think there's language markers even in English that it's not a betrayal of our English language or English culture. It's just these identity markers that help form that Japanese Mormon identity. And I doubt that they use that when they're at work or they're right. in associating with other people outside of the church.
You're probably right, and maybe this part of that is my own sensitivity to the fact that I sounded like a moron for 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to go back just for a second just to clarify. Like, I'm not saying that it's not valuable to the people that have converted. And that religion isn't valuable to them. If they believe it and if it makes them happy, then that's great. But the thing that I think is sad about it is that if it's okay, most religion is based on just stories, right? It's not, there's not real truth there. There's not actual, it's like not science-based fact stuff. It's folklore and legends and stories and traditions. And so most religion is based on that. And so you can't really say, well, it's not valuable if it's not true without having that caveat in there. But the thing about Mormonism is that it's just, it's like insidiously not true. Like it's covering up not true. You know what I mean? It's trying so hard to be organic in, as you know, the kind of way that Hinduism is organic. And like a lot of people that practice Hinduism, they don't really believe that there's 1,000 gods and that, you know, they have some crazy stories. I don't think that they actually believe those things, but it's organic and it's passed down from generations. But these people have given up the thing that was passed down to them for generations. And they're a culture and a race that is like disappearing. I mean, they are going to be, I read an article about the Japanese race that it could possibly be extinct within 1,000 years.
What?
And to me, that should, yeah. There's the way that...
Because the younger generation aren't reproducing.
They're not reproducing.
They don't date.
And they're so xenophobic that they're not, you know, accepting immigrants and stuff like that into their country. And that, to me, is just... Like, it's sad that they're giving up their culture.
The other part of Japanese culture is they borrow so much. Like, syncretism.
Sure. Every culture does, though.
Incredibly syncretic culture. Mm-hmm. So
we're talking about the LDS Church invading Japan, but Buddhism did that 1,000 years ago. They were all Shinto, and now Buddhism came. So I think that's right. The nature of religions and belief systems is now it's a fabric of who they are. And in 1,000 years, maybe the three Japanese people are all Mormon.
You're comparing Buddhism to Mormonism. It's like, I don't know.
Funny concept.
No, it's one of these things has a lot more weight than the other, I think. But maybe that's silly. Maybe I'm looking at it.
Well,
you've got
more convert cred than any of us do.
Absolutely.
So you know what you're talking about here.
I have almost zero Mormon cred, but I have
a ton of convert
a lot
cred.
Of convert cred.
Yeah. I've converted to non-belief.
Yeah. Well, I'm now feeling great about my undergraduate study choice. I think that the church itself in Japan does take on a little bit of a Japanese flavor, especially depending on where you're at. The simple thing that you see, I think you see this everywhere, is after the sacrament, you'll see the deacons and the priests or whoever's, sort of involved bow to each other afterwards in a very, sort of the way you would expect a Japanese person to do after doing something like that. And it doesn't seem out of place and it's, just fine. Some of the ugliest things I've actually seen in the church happened with trying to make the Japanese people more and the Japanese church members more American. There's this branch, no longer exists, it's been dissolved, but there's this branch way out in the middle of nowhere I was in for a while. And, the branch president, he was this guy who just surfed all day. He couldn't have cared less. He got up and he'd start using, I guess you could call it the Japanese equivalent of swearing from the pulpit, if you will. Glenn and Brad, he would, use the wrong personal pronouns and
oh, nice.
Add grammar forms and things like that, saying ore and all of this from the pulpit, which if I were to translate that, I'd translate that as some pretty, reasonable profanity. Nobody cared. And there was really kind of fast and loose rules. I saw a family come in late, halfway through one day. Everybody knows who they are. The branch president, in the middle of whoever was talking, ran to the sacrament table, grabbed the sacrament, both hands with a tray in it, ran to the back of the room, gave it to the family, ran back, and then came back and sat down. And you know what? Hey, that's kind of cool. The stake had the biggest problem with this, where they'd assigned some special high counselor who would come in and pontificate about how he once talked with you know, Marvin J. Ashton or some such thing. And all of us Utah-born missionaries are like, we're supposed to be impressed at this. You know, like I live next door to David B. Haight. What are you talking about? You know, but he would come in and try to shake it up and say, well, they're not doing this right. You need to tear the crusts off the bread and you need to. And these are things he really said. And we're just like, leave these guys alone. They're kind of doing it in their own Japanese way. They're having a good time. And that to me, when I saw sort of church bureaucracy try to enforce the American method or the Utah method of having church, that to me was some of the ugliest things I still think I've ever seen in the church.
I get maybe I'm projecting a little bit too of my own. Like, I don't feel like I have a real strong sense of tradition from my, you know, ancestors or, and giving up like all the Mormon traditions. Like, I miss some of that, but I would never go back to it. So I kind of feel like I'm without that. And so I'm sensitive to that maybe.
I can see that a little bit. I missed that in my own life. You know, the holidays, you know, you'd read the Christmas story of the Bible and stuff. And, you know, there was some other kind of more Mormon takes on things. And yeah, I can see that void, you know, as far as, you know, building a new tradition or something that's, you know, unique to me. Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to know how you guys feel about it now. So, like, you were all super excited about it back then, but how are you still excited about it? Like, I'm wondering if you think, was it an actual thing that happened to actual people, or is this just a religious story? Like, do you think there actually could be
lost tribes?
Lost tribes.
No.
No.
Is that a stupid question? That's probably a really dumb question.
No, I don't think it's stupid. I think
no, I don't either.
Well, I mean, if you're asking, did the Assyrians capture the northern kingdom of Ephraim and disperse the people throughout their kingdom? Yeah. So, is there like blood lineage out there that could be traced back? Sure. Does it mean anything? No. I mean, gotcha. So yeah, the parts that I miss, I miss the mystery, like feeling like I was on the inside of a mystery, and like looking when I would walk through a museum and I would see something that looked like something I was familiar with in Mormonism, going, aha, there's a clue, you know. It like I loved that. And it's the same type of thing that made me love the TV show Lost, and like all the little hidden Easter eggs and things that they'd put in there. Like this word on this funeral home, if you rearrange the letters, it's a palindrome that says this, you know, and there's all these Easter egg stuff. It was like there's Easter eggs within the Japanese culture that tie it to the Lost Tribes. And I know the real story behind what's going on. I don't know. I missed that part. And I still, you know, even some of the recent trips I've taken down to Peru or Mexico, and I'm walking around, you know, ruins or museums, and I see things, and I'm still thinking about, oh, is this evidence of Nephites and Lamanites? You know, like my brain's still wired in those ways to look for that, even though I kind of catch myself and I just laugh at it now. But yeah, does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I still think there's a lot of cool things that we didn't, like the comparisons to Israel. There's just a ton of them.
Right.
There's a ton of them. Like the Shinto shrine is the same layout as a temple, and there's a veil that people go up to and they knock three times.
Right, the three knocks.
Mm-hmm. And there's a holy of holies, and you know,
a whole
the
bunch
place
of
where
words.
They do washing. And, yeah, like the...
Right,
the one with like Noah and his family. What is that for? Oh, for Fune, for boat.
Yeah,
there's like eight people or something. Which it isn't. That isn't what it really. Those aren't really the characters in it, but that's what people say as you know.
Right. There's well, just a ton and of even stuff. The crust of the imperial house. You know,
oh, chrysanthemum.
Kind of that right that you can find on the gates of you know, Jerusalem.
Yeah.
The 16-pointed flower. Yeah, right. I think it's an exercise in seeing what you want to see once you've cracked into that world.
Yeah.
It is an awful lot of fun to try to find new things, and there are a lot you can find. And I think most of that is because you're in a culture that is so radically different from what you grew up in, that as your mind is reaching out to try to make sense of it all, it's easiest to adopt these bizarre things and fit them into a narrative you already have.
But
once you scratch that surface.
There's a huge subculture of people who believe in this, and like I said earlier, it's not just Mormons. There was one of the earliest Christian visitors to Japan once they reopened up. It was 1868. Was this Scottish guy? I used to think his name was Nolman MacLeod, Nolman, because that's what was written on the book. It's actually Norman, but I didn't figure that out until years later, and I'm like, okay, that makes sense. That's why I could never find any information on Nolman MacLeod. But he wrote a book that it only exists in Japanese. It's called The Epitome of Japanese Culture, and I was able to get a translated copy of it in English. He thought that the Japanese were the lost tribes of Israel, and he created this entire narrative of how they got from Assyria and where they landed in southern Japan and Kyushu, and how the samurai is named after where they had lived in Samaria, and they, he creates this whole history about how there was a conflict with the Japanese imperial family today. Are the remnant Israelites, and they know that they are, but they don't talk about it. And then there was a Japanese, or no, he's not Japanese, but he was a rabbi to Japan for 30 years. His name is Marvin Tokayer. And I flew out to San Diego to listen to him talk, give a lecture on this once. And he believes that there's a connection between the lost tribes and, or at least Judaism and Jewish tradition and Israel, and for things that he saw happening at Shinto shrines, like kids being 8 days old when they're named and given a blessing, and women not being able to, after they give birth, they have to wait 30 days before they can go to a shrine, or things like this that were similar, and palm fronds and the robes of the Shinto priest, and like a yarmulke, and there's a yarmulke.
That prayer box thingy, hat, yeah.
See, you said
there's so many things.
You said that it doesn't matter if they're connected, but to me, you describing all those things, that does matter, and that kind of speaks to what I was talking about earlier that I think is sad, because those things are carried through. I mean, if that's true, right? If they are the lost tribes. Those traditions are carried through thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And that's kind of cool, right? I mean, they don't mean anything, and maybe the people do them and they don't understand why, or they've created new stories as to why, but that connection between those two kind of very different worlds as they are now, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I guess the question is, if you gave me enough time with any culture, could I draw those parallels or not? I tend to think that there's enough, rich history in every culture, traditions and things that, I can connect certain dots. And so I guess my take is, there's some really cool things in Japan, and there are some similarities at a certain level, but I don't know that's unique by itself.
I don't know if you would have the same level of similarities in other cultures as you would with Japan. I think people have tried. They found similarities different, but they're like being a high context folk group or something. I mean, there's so many similarities. I think that is unique to the Japanese. Maybe the next would be the British Israelite theory. There's a lot there as well. Like they talk about a lion and a unicorn and these different symbols of the houses of Ephraim, and there's linguistic things there as well. But I think there. I don't know. I don't know. I think that the Japanese thing is a little closer, like there's more bullseyes than other places. But I don't think that means that they're the lost tribes of Israel. Mm. And a little piece of me dies when I say that. Yeah, I won't lie. But yeah, because I spent so much time studying this. I just loved it. I found it so fascinating. But what seems strange to me is and Nick sent me a link to this guy named Arimasa Kubo, who has a website about that has all these things on there, and he's an evangelical Christian. And so you've got evangelical Christians who believe this. Why? What do they get out of it? You've got a Japanese rabbi, or I keep calling him a Japanese rabbi. He's from New York, but Marvin Tokier, who lived in Japan for 30 years, he believes it. Why? Like, what is it validating for him? What is it validating for us as Mormons? And I think that the answer to each one of those questions is different. And so the connections and that quest for making the connection really tells you more about that group's identity, how they see themselves and define themselves and want to validate themselves, than it does about any real tangible history or lineage of the Japanese people, like connecting back to ancient Israel. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that's important. It's part of your personal identity and your familial identity and your cultural identity. It's a huge deal.
Yeah. And we're out.
And we're tired.
Tired, yeah.
This is Hillary.
Matthew, Ryan,
Carol,
Keith,
Ashley. And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Hey there. Hey, you know what we're out of? You know, fresh plum out of? We've run out of listener outros. I mean, it was great. We had about 8 of you that just sent things in right off the bat, and we've used them and kind of recycled some of them, but there's more than 8 of you listening to this. So how about going to our website, infantsonthrones.com, looking at the contact tab up at the top right-hand corner of the page. There's instructions. There's a little script. There's an email address. You can record and send it to us, and we'll use it. Please, pretty please, is there anything that I can do, anything that I can give you to incentivize you to do this? Maybe a little more President Monson backing player? Huh? Huh?
Just can't live. Baby, come back, come back, come back. Any kind of fool could truly see. There was something in everything about you. Baby, come back. You could blame it all on me. I was wrong, I was wrong. Come back, come back. I was wrong.
Come on, please, please. Help us out, help us out, help us out.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.